You are ready.
Ready, Daddy.
Ready?
I'm ready.
Hi, everybody. My name is Charlie Parham, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 13,323 days today, one day at a time. It's great to be back up in this part of the world. It's been a long time since we've been up here. I was sitting here while Joe was talking and Vinny was talking, and I was just looking around the room. You guys are about the finest looking bunch of sick people I've seen in a long time. You're looking great tonight. You're looking great. We always like to say as we start one of these things that we do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't consider ourselves to be the experts on anything at all. We're just two old drunks, met together several years ago, found we have a mutual interest in the Big Book, studied it together for quite some time, and hopefully we've learned a few things about it. And those few things we've learned about it, we just love to be able to share them with other people. We do not attempt to speak for AA as a whole, and you are most certainly free to agree or disagree with anything that we say throughout the entire weekend. In fact, if you hear us saying things that can't be reconciled with what's in the Big Book, we suggest you don't pay any attention to those things at all. And we'll try to keep most of our comments centered on the book itself. We also like to recognize the fact that the mind will only absorb about what the rear end will stand. Some of these sessions do become quite long. For instance, tonight we're not going to take a break. If we do, we'll just be here way too late this evening. But if you feel the need to get up and move around a little bit, please feel free to do so. If you feel the need to go out and smoke a cigarette, get a cup of coffee, please feel free to do so. That's not going to bother us at all. Or if you feel the need to go get rid of a cup of coffee, please feel free to do so. That's not going to bother us either. No sense in sitting there suffering in silence when you don't need to. As we go through the book, we love to laugh. We love to cut up. We love to tell jokes. We love to hear other people laugh also. And from time to time, we may stop whatever we're doing, tell a little joke just to get some humor started. And if we tell one and it's not funny, well, go ahead and laugh anyhow. It'll be good for you and good for us and good for everybody else if we can approach this thing with that idea in mind. Now, we're not going to try to learn something about the Big Book, but we're going to have some fun while we're doing it. I think we're all in for a good, good, exciting weekend. And I always like to start it by telling a little joke, and I think it's so appropriate for we alcoholics. And the joke I love the most is a story about the brain surgeon. The brain surgeon had developed a way to transplant the human brain in its entirety. Been doing it for a long time with the other organs of the body, but he figured out a way to do it with the brain. And this older fellow went to him and said, "Doc, I've been having problems with my brain. I can't figure anything out anymore. I can't think. I can't remember. Do you think you can do anything to help me out?" The doctor said, "Well, let's give you a good physical, and if your body's okay, then we'll take a look at the brain." So he gave him a good physical exam, checked him out, and he said, "Oh, yeah, your body's in great shape." He said, "I believe we could transplant a brain into your head, and everything would be just great." And the old man said, "Okay, what do you have to offer?" And the surgeon said, "Well, let's go up in the display room, and I'll show you what we've got on stock at the present time." He took him up in a display room and he said, "Now over here in this case I have the brains of an attorney." And he said, "I could transplant this in your head and everything would be great and it'll cost you $20,000. The old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh yeah. In this case over here I have the brains of a doctor." He said, "I could transplant this in your head and everything would be great and it'll cost you $30,000. The old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh yeah." He said, "In this case over here, I have the brains of an alcoholic." He said, "I could transplant this in your head. head, everything would be great. It'll cost you $50,000. The old man said, I don't understand this deal. $20,000 for the attorney's brain, $30,000 for the doctor's brain, and $50,000 for an alcoholic's brain. The surgeon said, well, hell yes, man, it's brand new. It's never been used before. I think most of us will go to the grave with about at least 60% left unused that we never did use during our lifetime. So, Joe, you got anything?
I was going to tell a story before he threw me off and called me to read that preamble, but the story of this little Aflac duck, you know, the little Aflac duck. Well, he went in the grocery store one day and he asked the produce manager if he had any grapes. He said, no, we don't have any grapes. So the next day he went in there and said, sir, do you have any grapes? He said, I told you yesterday I don't have any grapes, and I still don't have any grapes. The next day he went in and said, sir, do you have any grapes? He said, look, I've told you twice now we don't have any grapes. We still don't have any grapes. And if you come in here one more time asking for grapes, I'm going to staple your feet to the floor. And next morning he walks in. He said, sir, he said, yes. Do you have any staples? He said, no. He said, you got any grapes? I don't know why I like that. I think he may be an alcoholic or something. I don't know.
Okay, if we're going to study the big book, which of course is what we're here for this weekend, I think we probably ought to go back and look at just a little bit of the history behind the book, to look at a few of the things that the original members had to go through, things they had to learn, some of the things they had to do in order to recover from alcoholism. And if we can do that, then I think it's going to make it a lot easier for us to understand the book as we go through it. So to look at a little bit of the history of it, we like to open the book right up. And let's go to the forward to the second edition. And that's Roman numeral 15. And let's go to the last paragraph on that page and look at just a little bit of the history behind the book itself.
You know, Bill has a little formula that he uses in all of his writings. Certainly he used it in the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous, but he used it in everything he ever wrote. The first thing he always does is he tells us what the problem is. Make sure we understand the problem. And then he gives us a solution to that problem. And then he gives us a practical program of action to implement the solution that he just described. He does that over and over and over. So anytime you read anything by Bill, you can see that little formula. And certainly the book of Alcoholics Anonymous is laid out in that fashion. Bottom of the page. The spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician.
Okay, we know this New York stockbroker is this fellow named Bill Wilson. I think we're treating Bill pretty good when we call him a New York stockbroker. He really wasn't. He was a New York City stock speculator. He made his living out of selling fast, talking to slow-thinking people. We don't want to take anything away from Bill. He was a great man. But we all need to recognize the fact he's a real alcoholic, just like all the rest of us, and it makes it easier to understand the book, because Bill is the primary author of the book. We know the Akron physician is this fellow named Dr. Bob Smith.
Now, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day.
As we get into Bill's story later on, we're going to see where there was a fellow named Ebby Thatcher that came to see Bill in Bill's kitchen in the latter part of November of 1934. And he was an old drinking buddy of Bill's, an old school friend of Bill's. And he sat down with Bill and he gave him what turned out to be two very vital pieces of information. He said, Bill, people like you and I that have become entirely powerless over alcohol, if we're going to recover from that condition, we're going to have to have the aid of a power greater than human power. He said, we've tried the doctors, we've tried the ministers, we've tried the psychiatrists, we've tried our own power, and all of it has failed. But he said, if we could have the aid of a power greater than human power, then we can recover from alcoholism. And he said, I've been attending meetings with a group of people called the Oxford Groupers. And they told me that if I could have a spiritual experience, that during that spiritual experience I would be able to find a power greater than human power, and I wouldn't have to drink anymore. He said they also outlined for me a practical program of action. And they guaranteed me if I would follow that practical program of action, I would have that spiritual experience, I would find the power, and I wouldn't have to drink anymore. And he said, look at me, Bill. He said, I've been sober for 2 months. This made a great impression on Bill, because he knew Ebbie Thatcher, and he knew how Ebbie drank. And he knew that if Ebbie had been sober for 2 months, some power, certainly greater than Ebbie, had to be working in Ebbie's life. And what Ebbie really gave to Bill during that particular meeting, he first gave him the solution to alcoholism, the vital spiritual experience during which we find the power greater than human power. Then he also outlined for him that program of action. And we know that shortly thereafter, Bill went into the hospital and was detoxed, and they began to apply the program of action. And lo and behold, Bill recovered from that condition known as alcoholism. But there was another piece of information that he also had to know that he didn't get from Ebbie Thatcher. He got the solution, he got the program of action from Ebbie, but he didn't really understand what the problem was until he met a little doctor called Dr. Silkworth.
He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. Now, from this doctor, the broker learned the grave nature of alcoholism.
And again, when we get into Bill's story, we're going to see where as far back in the summer of 1933, Bill was placed in the town hospital in New York City, withdrawn from alcohol by a little doctor called Dr. Silkworth. In the summer of 1933, Dr. Silkworth sat down with Bill and explained to him his ideas about alcoholism. He said, Bill, I do not believe alcoholism is a matter of willpower. I don't believe it's a matter of moral character, and I don't think sin's got anything to do with it. He said, I really believe people like you who are suffering from alcoholism, you're suffering from an illness. And he said, it's a very peculiar illness. It seems to be a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind. And he said, it's been my experience after working with many, many alcoholics, that whenever guys like you put any alcohol whatsoever into your body, that it develops an actual physical craving for more of the same. And he said that craving is so strong that it's beyond your ability to control the amount you're going to drink after you have once started drinking. And he said, because of that craving of the body, you'll never be able to successfully drink alcohol again as long as you live. Every time you try it, you're going to end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. But he said, Bill, that's just half of your problem. He said, I also believe that people like you have developed what we call an obsession of the mind. And he said, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. And it is so strong that it can make you believe something that is not true. He said, now the truth is you can't successfully drink alcohol. And from time to time, you realize you can't successfully drink alcohol. So you muster your willpower and you stop drinking. But he said, after a while, your mind begins to remember the great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. And next thing you know, you get to thinking about what alcohol is going to do for you rather than what it does to you, and you believe that you can drink again. And based on the idea that this time it's going to be different, you take that first drink, and then that first drink triggers that allergy, and then you end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. He said you can no longer safely drink because of the body, nor can you stay sober because of the mind. Therefore, you have become absolutely powerless over alcohol. In the summer of 1933, Bill knew what the problem was. For the first time, he understood it. And he said, now that I know what's wrong with me, I'll not have to drink anymore. And we know that in a short period of time, he got drunk again. He drank until 1934. Placed back in a town hospital in the summer of 1934, and again withdrawn by Dr. Silkworth. And this time, Dr. Silkworth pronounced him incurable and said, this guy is going to die during DTs, or he's going to become a wet brain within a short period of time. He is hopeless. And Bill overheard that. And he said fear sobered him up for a little bit. But in our Armistice Day 1934, his mind told him it's okay to drink again. And he took a drink and triggered the allergy and couldn't stop. So knowing his problem as far back as 1933 didn't solve it. It's only when Ebby brought him the solution, the idea of the vital spiritual experience, brought him the program of action, that Bill was able to recover from alcoholism by having what he always referred to as a vital spiritual experience. He knew three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And what is the program of action? And based on that, he could recover.
Ebby began to take Bill to these Oxford Group meetings. And there he was introduced to the tenets of the Oxford Group. And our book says that though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford Group, he was convinced of the need of moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God, which we know that later on, along with some other things, those tenets were expanded into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill liked that idea about being helpful with other people and to other people. He liked that. So he began to go into the bars along the streets and drag people out of those bars and take them to these Oxford Group meetings with him. He'd go out in the streets and send them up out of the gutters and take them to the Oxford Group meetings with him. Most of them didn't want to go. But Bill was taking them anyhow because he was trying to help them stay sober. He did that for about 6 months. And after about 6 months, nobody was staying sober. So he ultimately went to Dr. Silkworth and said, look, I've been trying to help all these people out there and nobody seems to want what I have. And Dr. Silkworth said, well, Bill, I've heard about some of those shenanigans you're pulling out there on the streets, making those people go to those Oxford Group meetings, talking to them about this great spiritual experience that you had. You know, so why don't you do for them what I did for you? Why don't you talk to them about the illness of alcoholism? Explain to them what the problem is. Talk to them about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And if they accept that, then you can talk to them about the great spiritual experience, the solution that you had. So Bill began to do that. And said prior to his journey to Akron, shortly thereafter, he went to Akron to engage in a proxy fight. The broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic, but he succeeded only in keeping sober himself. The broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic. That alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. And of course, we know the story that Bill went to Akron to take over this company called the Akron Tool and Machine Company, which was a real plum of a company, and the proxy fight fell through. Bill's back in the Mayflower Hotel, pacing back and forth, wondering what he's going to do. He doesn't have enough money to pay his hotel bill, certainly doesn't have enough money to get back home on, so what's he going to do? And we know the story that Bill looked off into the bar there off the lobby. People were drinking and smoking and having a good time. He thought he might go in there. And then he said, no, if I go in there, I'll probably drink again. Then he remembered that every time he helped another alcoholic, he himself felt better. He said, I think I'm going to go find me someone that I can help. And I think about that story all the time. And I remember Bill wrote a little piece in the Alcoholic Comes of Age. And one of the statements he said, what slender threads our destiny does lie. And I think about those slender threads, and we all have those slender threads ourselves, along with Bill. If it was up to me to go into that bar and have a drink, or to go over here and help a drunk, you know which way I'm going, don't you? If I go in the bar, there'd be no AA. If Bill goes in the bar, there'd be no AA, and we won't be sitting here. What slender threads that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Very precious AA is. Thank God he made the decision to go help a drunk.
We know that Bill made a few phone calls, came in contact with this lady named Henrietta Sarbanning, and said, I'm a runhound from New York City, and I'm here in Akron, and I'm just about to get drunk, and I need to find an alcoholic I can talk to. And Henrietta set him up with a meeting with Dr. Bob. She said, I'll try to set up a meeting for you tomorrow here at my home. So she called Dr. Bob's house and talked to Ann, Dr. Bob's wife, and told Ann about this guy from New York City that thought he had an answer to alcoholism, and he would like to talk to another alcoholic to keep himself from getting drunk. And he said, why don't you bring Dr. Bob over and they can visit with each other. And Henrietta said, Henrietta, I would love to bring Dr. Bob over. But she said, you know, tomorrow is Mother's Day, and he's brought me home a potted plant for Mother's Day, and he's potted under the kitchen table right now. But she said, you set it up for tomorrow, and I'll try to bring him over tomorrow. And they got up the next morning, and Ann set in on Dr. Bob to go over to Henrietta's to talk to this rumhound from New York City. Dr. Bob was hungover, sick, feeling lousy, and he said, I'm not going. And she said, well, yeah, I think you really ought to go. This guy might have the answer to your problem. Dr. Bussa said, I don't want to talk to any other drunk. None of them know what the hell they're talking about anyhow. She said, well, you're going to go. And he said, no, I'm not. And she said, yeah, you are. And eventually she pressured him into it. And he said, I'll go over there and give that guy 15 minutes of my time, and then I'm leaving. And they went over to Henrietta's, and Bill and Bob went off in a room by themselves. 5 hours later, they came out of that room. And Dr. Bob said, this is the first man I ever met that knew what he was talking about when he was talking about alcoholism. Because you see, Bill did something here he had never done before. He didn't try to force his great spiritual experience on Dr. Bob. He didn't talk about the great white flash that he had had in the town's hospital. He did what Dr. Silkworth told him to do. He said to Dr. Bob, let me tell you about my drinking. Didn't talk about Dr. Bob's drinking at all. And he began to explain that many, many times I would be on the way home and I would stop off in a speakeasy to have a drink, and then I was going to go home and have dinner with Lois. And he said, I would take a drink, and the next thing you know, I would have to have a second and a third, and I may not get home at all that evening, may not get home until the next day. Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been happening to me. And Bill said, well, this little doctor in New York City explained to me that this is an actual physical allergy of the body, and it creates a craving in our body which is so strong that we can't control the amount that we drink after we once start drinking. He continued to tell him about the many, many times that he had sworn off drinking. He said, I've got a tremendous amount of willpower. I've always been able to do anything I wanted to do. And he said, I would wake up one morning and I'd swear off and say, I'll never take another drink as long as I live. And he said, by that afternoon, I'm sitting in a bar wondering how in the hell did it happen this time. Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been wrong with me. And Bill explained to him that this little Dr. Silkworth had called that an obsession of the mind. And said, doesn't make any difference how smart we are. Doesn't make any difference what our professional standing is. Doesn't make any difference how much willpower we got. From time to time, our mind is going to tell us it's okay to drink. And we end up taking a drink, and then we end up drunk. I always wondered how this old New York City stockbroker, stock speculator, could explain to a well-trained surgeon what was wrong with his body and his mind. But he did it simply by telling him what Dr. Silkworth had told him. For the first time, Dr. Bob understood the problem. Our book says, this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. He was already a member of the Oxford groups in Akron, Ohio. He was already trying to have a spiritual experience, but he had never been able to apply their program of action to the depth necessary to recover because he didn't know what was wrong with him. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another, as no non-alcoholic could, Bill sharing his story with Dr. Bob. And for the first time, Dr. Bob understood the problem. It also indicated strenuous work one alcoholic with another was vital for permanent recovery. Remember, Bill Wilson was just about to get drunk. He didn't go see Dr. Bob to sober up Dr. Bob. He went to see Dr. Bob to keep Bill Wilson from getting drunk. So the very two things our whole fellowship is built upon was experienced during that particular visit. One alcoholic can affect another as no non-alcoholic can. Strenuous work with another alcoholic is vital for our own recovery.
Hence the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. One night, Dr. Bob and Bill were sitting there talking, and Dr. Bob said, "Well, Bill, we better get busy." He said, "Get busy doing what?" "Helping drunks." He said, "The helping drunks would help us." He said, "But I'm not from Akron. I don't know any drunks here. Do you?" And he said, "No, I really don't. But I know a lady down at the Akron City Hospital. Surely to God, she'll know a drunk." So he calls up that head nurse and says, "I've got this rum hound from New York. I think about that. Henrietta Cyberling. A very educated woman from Vassar. And here's this guy that calls up and says, I'm a rum hound." Don't that really just turn you on? I mean, you know. But they had been praying that Dr. Bob would find a solution for his drinking problem, and here it shows up. See, that's why they were able to get together so easy. But they decided to go see this head nurse. She said, "Yeah, I've got the fellow down here. He's in the ward of the hospital. And we got him strapped down real tight." She said, "Oh, by the way, Dr. Bob, have you tried this solution on yourself?" She knew that he, too, was a drunk. He said, "Yes, I have, and I'm staying sober." And the ward is, some of you all know what a ward is. That's to the end of the hall where you can't afford a private room or a semi-private room. They put you at the end of the hall, put some screens around you. It looks like if you're going to die, they take you off the ward and put you in a private room so you can die with a little dignity. So they said, "Put this guy off the ward and put him in a private room, and we'll be down to see him in the morning." So the next morning, Dr. Bob and Bill went in to see this fellow named Bill Dotson, AA number 3. And he sat down with Bill Dotson, the lawyer. And this time they didn't do what they had done before. This time they began to talk about their drinking. They weren't talking about Bill Dotson's drinking. They began to talk about their drinking. And he began to identify with those two. He said, "You guys are just like me. I drink just the way you do." So that identification was set up. And eventually, a couple of days later, he told his wife, said, "Get my clothes. I'm going to get out of this hospital. I'm going to go do what those guys are doing." And he never had another drink again until he died in 1966.
Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. He never had another drink. Now, this work at Akron continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. You know, we look back at that period of time, and we always give credit to Bill and Bob and Bill Dotson and all of that first 100 people, and rightfully we should. But I think we also need to stop once in a while and give credit to those that they failed with, too. You know, during that summer of 1935, they didn't really know what they were doing. They would try something, and if it worked, they would retain it. If it didn't, they would discard it and try something else. One of Dr. Bob's favorite things was to fill the new person up with sauerkraut juice mixed with honey. The sauerkraut juice had the vitamins necessary, and the honey made it possible for him to drink the damn stuff. They tried that amongst many things, and every once in a while, one of these guys would fall over dead. No, old Seville turned to Bob and say, "Oh, shit, let's don't do that again." I think maybe we ought to give credit to those that they failed with as well as those they succeeded with. They probably learned more from the failures than they did from their successes. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. What Bill left behind him in the fall of 1935 was just a few people who were staying sober based on these three little pieces of information. What is the problem? What is the solution? What is the program of action? They were all members of the Oxford group. There was no AA at that time. Now, the alcoholics didn't fit in with the Oxford groupers too good to start with. The Oxford groupers were really not into the business of sobering up drunks. They wanted to help out the more elite members of society to get their lives straightened out. Maybe help the mayor of the town, the governor of the state, the president of the company. You know how that goes. And they didn't particularly care for the alcoholics. The alcoholics would sit around in the meetings and tell dirty jokes and smoke cigarettes and drop ashes on the floor and spill coffee on the carpets and etc. The alcoholics were not too crazy about the Oxford groupers. The Oxford groupers had one thing that the alcoholics really did not like. They had what they called the four absolutes. You were to practice absolute love, absolute honesty, absolute purity, and absolute unselfishness. The alcoholics were having a hell of a time being anything except absolute alcoholics. So to separate themselves from the Oxford groupers, they called themselves the drunk squad of the Oxford group. That's what Bill left behind him in Akron in the summer of 1935, the drunk squad of the Oxford group. He went back to New York City, and there he began to apply what he had really learned to do when he called on Dr. Bob. He found him a drunk, and he began to talk about his own story. Didn't talk about spirituality to start with. Talked about the physical allergy of the body, the obsession of the mind. And then after he got the guy's interest, then he talked to him about spirituality and the program of action. And lo and behold, one or two started getting sober back in New York City. A second small group had promptly taken shape at New York. And besides, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York and were trying to form AA groups in other cities. 1937, during the summer, Bill is back in Akron, Ohio, again on a business venture. He goes by to visit with Dr. Bob to see how things are going in Akron. And they sat down and counted heads of those that they knew were staying sober on these three little pieces of information. And they found that it was a total of 40 people staying sober. And I think for the first time, they began to realize we may have found the answer to alcoholism. If there's 40 alcoholics staying sober on it, surely it has some depth and has some meaning. So they said to themselves, well, what are we going to do about this information then? Are we going to keep it for ourselves? Are we going to franchise it and sell it? What are we going to do with it? Now, one of the things coming out of the Oxford groupers always was that if you're going to keep it, you've got to give it away. So they began to try to determine what would be the best method of giving it away. And maybe this is the beginning of the group conscience. They decided they didn't want to make that decision themselves. So they called a meeting of those there in Akron. And at that meeting, there was a total of about 17 or 18 people there. Not all were alcoholics. And they discussed, how could we best carry this particular information to the greatest number of people? And one of the things they decided to do that night was to build a chain of hospitals stretching all the way across the United States where any alcoholic could go in for detox. Probably Dr. Bob was going to be the head doctor. This is during the Depression. Nobody's got a dime, but we're going to build these hospitals anyhow. They also decided that just not everybody would be able to carry this information, that they really needed to set up a kind of a schooling thing and hire and train some people to carry this message across the country. And surely Bill Wilson was going to be the head missionary, as sure as anything. And one guy said, well, you know, well, there's never been a decent book written on alcoholism yet. He said, now the Oxford groupers have been writing lots of books on spirituality and they're selling good. And in those days, people read a lot. You know, this was the days before television. And believe me, there really was a day before television. There really was. And they said, what we need to do is write a book on alcoholism, taking this information that we have learned, put it down in the written form, so that alcoholics in the future will be able to see what their problem is, be able to see a solution to that problem, and be able to see the program of action necessary to do so. They said already carrying it by word of mouth, it's beginning to become changed. It's beginning to become garbled. And if we don't get it down in written form, sooner or later it will become absolutely worthless. And they said we could take this book and it would be the first book ever written on alcoholism, a really comprehensive book on alcoholism. It would probably become one of the world's best sellers. They said we could take the profits from the book and we could build the hospitals and hire and train the missionaries. So they decided to do three things that night. Thank God only one thing came true. They never did build the hospitals. They never did hire and train the missionaries. And as I look at it now, we didn't need to. You know, other people have built the hospitals. We didn't need to do that. Other people have hired and trained the missionaries. We call them counselors. We didn't need to do that. But we did do one thing. We wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous that came out in 1939.
Can you see the mind of the alcoholic working, building hospitals and hiring and training missionaries and earning money? Thank God those things didn't happen. So it's now time the struggling group sought to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume. The membership had then reached about 100 men and women. And after they wrote the book, they decided, well, we're going to have to name the book. So they began to talk about what they were going to call the book. Somebody says, well, let's call it The Way Out. Sounds like a pretty good name for a book. Done some research on that. Found out there were 12 or 13 other titles called The Way Out, so they discarded that. Somebody come up with the idea, let's call it Comes the Dawn.
Good
title. Doesn't it sound good? Comes the Dawn. But they decided not to do that. Bill said, well, let's just call it the Bill W. Movement. About 5 seconds later, they said, no, we're not going to do that. And then somebody said, well, let's call it 100 Men. Now, doesn't that sound like a good name for a book? Guys, hey, 100 Men? Well, then a woman joined the group. Well, they couldn't call it 100 Men and a Woman. So they just started that. And there was a guy there from a nut house, treatment center, and the same thing. And they had brought him to the meeting, and he was sitting off in the corner over there, and he was kind of on some of that Thorazine stuff, kind of drooling down both corners of his mouth, began to mumble. And he mumbled off Anonymous Alcoholics, Alcoholics Anonymous. And that kind of caught on. Said, hey, let's call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's rather apropos that a nut from a nut house named alcoholic. What slender threads do we have?
The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. So the first Alcoholics Anonymous that the world ever saw was a book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is the story of how the first 100 men and women recovered from alcoholism. Then the little society, which at that time was only 40 people, it was 100 by the time the book was published, it was 40 whenever they decided to write it. The little society, which had been nameless, now began to call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of the book. So in 1939, we had two Alcoholics Anonymouses. We had a fellowship of men and women who joined together searching for sobriety. We had a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, which had the program of recovery that the first 100 members of AA had used in order to recover. So in 1939, there was no quarrel at all between the program in the fellowship and the program in the book, because all those in the fellowship had used the program in the book. The book began to go out across the country, and somebody up here in Michigan got a copy of this book, read it, studied it, did what it said, recovered from alcoholism, and started an AA group. First one in California did the same thing, the first one in Florida, the first one in Texas, the first one here, there, and all over the United States, and going up into Canada. So the great growth of the fellowship really, really began to come from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. As the fellowship got bigger and bigger and bigger, they began to notice something that the first 100 didn't have. They began to notice the great amount of power that comes from large groups of men and women who have joined together for a common purpose. You know, one of the greatest elements of power to be found anywhere is when a large group of people who have suffered the common peril join together and they help and they support each other, and there's a tremendous amount of power in that. And as the fellowship got bigger and bigger and bigger, then they began to question the severity of the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they began to say, you know, do you really think we need to do everything that book says? Do we have to turn our entire will and life over to the care of God as we understand Him? Couldn't we just give Him the alcohol and keep the rest? You mean we're going to have to take an inventory of ourselves and write it down on paper and then go talk about it to another human being? We already know it. God knows it. Why in the hell should I share it with another human being? You mean we're going to have to get rid of all of our character defects? Hell, we wouldn't have any personality left at all if we did that. You mean we're going to have to make a list of all those people we've harmed and become willing to make amends to them, even though they've harmed us just as bad? And I begin to say, well, maybe we don't have to do all that. You know, maybe we can kind of treat it like a cafeteria. Maybe we can take some and maybe we can leave some. And the instant they begin to do that, the program and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous begin to change. And the program began to become less and less and less and less and less important. Then came the great advent of the treatment centers. Now, please don't get us wrong. We got nothing against treatment centers. They serve a worthwhile purpose. But in most treatment centers, in order to get the funding that comes through the federal government, through the state, through the mental health departments, they've got to talk about a lot of things other than what's in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they begin to talk in those treatment centers using terms that had never been heard before. They begin to talk about chemical dependency. They begin to talk about dual addiction. They begin to talk about poly addiction. They begin to talk about meaningful relationships. They begin to talk about significant others. Then those people from the treatment centers would come to the AA meeting, and naturally they wanted to talk about what they had learned in the treatment center. So that particular vocabulary began to come in AA and spread all the way throughout AA. And in some cases it got so bad you would go to an AA meeting, and if they didn't read the preamble before the meeting, you wouldn't know what kind of meeting you were in, because they talked about everything except alcoholism and recovery therefrom. You know, we call those group depression meetings. You go in there feeling pretty good. Halfway through the meeting, you might as well just blow your brains out. Hell, there's no sense in living at all. So what we're going to talk about this weekend is not the program in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to talk about the program in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God the program in the book has never been changed. It's the same today as it was when it appeared in 1939. You know, a lot of the old members of AA blame this particular problem on the newcomer. They say, well, the newcomer comes in here and he wants to talk about everything except alcoholism, and I can't identify with him, and I'm sick of that crap, and I'm just going to stay home. But when the old-timer does that, then we have abdicated our responsibility for AA. We've turned it over to the sickest of the sickest, who are the newcomers, and then we stand back and say, look what they're doing to our AA. No, it's not the newcomer's fault. It's the old-timer's fault. You know, and hopefully, we're slowly, slowly getting back into the point of where more and more AA groups are getting out the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, talking about the program in the book, studying the book, and affecting good recovery from alcoholism.
Many, many years ago, I called my sponsor, Franklin, at the time. He's dead now, but I said, Franklin, my program's not working at all. He said, well, Joe, tell me about your program. And I said, well, generally, I'm mad at my wife and the people I work with and people I go to meetings with. I'm just mad wherever I am. And he said, well, Joe, your program's working just the way it was designed to work. He said, have you ever tried working the program? And there's a lot of difference between my program and the program that's in this book. Thank God I got that message. Now, Roman numeral page 20, when the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was practicing the principles that was in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, great things began to happen. He said, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds. For this, there were two principal reasons: the large number of recoveries and reunited homes. These made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. Among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about two out of three, began to return as time passed. If my math is correct, that's 75% of those people who came today stayed sober. You know, I don't think we can talk about 75%. Can't even fantasize about 50% today, 25%, 10% or less. So what happened? The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous got away from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the recovery rate went down. Bill wrote a little pamphlet. And I think everybody in AA ought to have one and read it. 1958. Problems Other Than Alcohol. Bill Wilson wrote this. And right there on the third page, it says this. He said, sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. I'll read that again. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. It's not one of the purposes. It is the sole purpose. The only reason to have an AA group is the practice and teaching of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, talking about sobriety. And Bill Wilson said that. And I believe, and I've seen this happen all over the country, when people begin to go back to this and begin to practice and teach the 12 steps, the recovery rate goes back up. I've seen that happen everywhere.
You know, I think I could say today that an alcoholic who comes to AA and really tries our program according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, at least 50% of them sober up immediately. Mm-hmm. 25% sober up after some relapse. And among the remainder, those that stays on come back and get sober too. You know, if they really, really try the program in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, we're not going to preach anymore. That's all the preaching we'll do this weekend. Guarantee you that. More preaching.
Hope you don't believe that.
No. Now that we understand a little bit of the history behind the book, let's go to the table of contents. Roman numeral number 5. Let's look at the layout of the book. And let's see if we can't see the same thing here that we were talking about that all the first 100 had to know. You know, in order for you to recover from any kind of problem, and I don't care what the problem is, to recover from a problem, you first have to understand the problem. And the problem with alcoholism, for thousands and thousands of years, nobody ever understood the problem of alcoholism. It's only when Dr. Silkworth came along in the 1930s, talked to Bill Wilson, we began to understand the problem of alcoholism. And Bill knew the problem, but that wasn't enough to recover. He also had to know the solution. He also had to know the program of action. And then he recovered from alcoholism. Dr. Bob knew the solution. He knew the program of action, but he didn't know the problem. It's only when he learned the problem that he could recover from alcoholism. So they decided to take the information that they had gathered and put it down in written form in the same sequence necessary for them to recover from alcoholism. And the first thing we got to know in order to recover from alcoholism is what is the problem. And we find it in the doctor's opinion and in Bill's story. A little bit of it in chapter 2 and 3, but most of it in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, we'll find out what the problem is. We'll find out why we are powerless over alcohol. and why our lives have become unmanageable. So really, in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, we're primarily dealing with step one, and we'll boil step one down to this one word: we are powerless. In our case, we're powerless over alcohol. Now, if you're powerless, then obviously the answer is going to lie within power. And remember that Evie said to Bill, we're going to have to have the aid of a power greater than ourselves. So in chapter 2, there is a solution. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Chapter 4, we agnostics. We talk about that power that is necessary for us to be able to have in order to overcome our powerless condition. So in those three steps, or those three chapters, we're really talking about step 2. That's where we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It talks about that power. It talks about the insanity. It talks about what happens if we don't find that power. And thank God in the chapter we agnostic, it gives us some new ideas about that power. And through those three chapters, we can come to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity, or step 2. Now, if the problem is powerless, and if the answer lies within power, then the only other thing we need to know is, well, how do you find that power? And we'll find in chapter 5 how it works. Chapter 6, into action. Chapter 7, working with others. We will find the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we follow the program outlined in the last 10 steps, then we're guaranteed in step 12 that we will have a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience, and we will have found the power. We studied this book for years before we began to realize, hey, this thing is written in a certain sequence to bring about certain ideas. And one idea building on another idea, building on another idea, building on another idea. When I first started looking at it, I read it as a novel. And there were parts in it I kind of liked. Some of the stories in the back, I kind of enjoyed those. I sure as hell didn't care for chapter 2, I'll guarantee you. I read a little bit in chapter 5, and I said, there's no way I'm going to do that. So I just kind of jumped around in it, and I got nothing out of it. But if we begin to realize it is written in a certain sequence to convey these same three ideas, to give us the same three goals that Bill and Bob in the first 100 had to know, then this thing becomes a very, very fascinating book as we progress through it. I get amused at people today. They say, we're going to a step study meeting, and they're always talking about the 12 and 12. But if you're studying the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, you are in a step study meeting. Because all the steps are here. They're all broken down in these chapters. And as we're reading and studying those chapters, we're actually studying the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Really amazed me when I saw that. Joe, you got anything on that? Okay. Let's flip over to the preface of the book. Roman numeral 11, second paragraph. Because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume, describing the AA recovery program, has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and the third editions, and now we could say the fourth edition. I happen to be reading from a third edition. I think there's two ideas there we need to look at. Number one, because this book has become the basic text for our society. I see the word basic text. I think I'm alerted to the kind of book I have in front of me. You know, there's all kind of books in the world today. We've got novels written some on fact and some on fiction. We've got biographies, we've got autobiographies, we've got concordances. We could name lots of different kind of books. But there's one kind of book that we all know about and we all are familiar with. And some of us don't like it at all. And those are things called textbooks. Remember how you had to use them in school? You had to read and study when you really would rather be outside doing something else. You had to take tests with the possibility of failure, and etc. And many of us have an aversion to the idea of a textbook.
For some reason, every time I think about textbook, I think about cheap. I don't know why that is.
But if you look at a textbook in its simplest form, all it is a way to transfer information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book. The textbook is nearly always written in a sequence. It usually assumes that the reader of the book knows very little about the subject matter. Normally starts at a simple level. Then as the knowledge of the reader increases, the information presented becomes more difficult. Let's take a textbook on mathematics. Let's say my friend Joe here knows nothing at all about mathematics. He can't add, he can't subtract, he can't do any of those things. Oh, he can count. He could probably count to 21. If he's standing there naked and got everything where it's supposed to be, he might make 21.
20 and a half, actually.
And I walk up to Joe and I hand him a textbook on mathematics and I say, I want you to go to chapter 5 and do those algebra problems. Well, being a good fellow, he'll go to chapter 5, look at it. He can't even add and subtract. He just sees a bunch of markings on paper. He doesn't understand it at all. But if I say, Joe, chapter 1 deals with the value of numbers, addition and subtraction. If you'll read it, study it, ask questions, let me help you. By the time you're through with chapter 1, you'll know how to add and subtract. And sure enough, he learns how to do that. And I say, now that you know how to add and subtract, you can go to chapter 2 and you can learn fractions and decimals. And then he can go to chapter 3 and learn a little more. And finally, by the time he gets to 5, his mind is prepared for the algebra problems. I think the greatest mistake being made in AA today, and I see it happening all the time, is somebody will hand a newcomer the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. They'll say, go to chapter 5 and do what it says and you'll be okay. The newcomer goes to chapter 5 and they read a series of algebra problems. Step 1 said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. The newcomer said, man, I'm not powerless over anything. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Step 2 says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Newcomer said, man, don't tell me I'm crazy. Yeah, I do stupid things when I'm drunk, but when I'm sober, I'm like other people. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Well, if you're not powerless and you're not nuts, then you don't need to be making a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of something you don't understand in the first place. And we present them with an impossible situation. If we can do nothing else all weekend, I hope we're going to be able to see the value of the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. They are where we get the information to prepare us for the algebra problems in chapter 5. You see, chapter 5 starts with step 3. Very difficult to start with 3 unless you've got 1 and 2 behind you. And it's very difficult to get 1 and 2 behind you unless you understand what they're talking about in those 2 steps. Standard textbook procedure. I think the other thing that is so important, since this book has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second edition, third edition, and fourth edition. The only changes we've made are the stories in the back of the book. In 1956, they said, you know, those stories in the back of the book no longer accurately reflect the membership. They were nearly all men, most of them low-bottom, fairly aged. More and more people were coming in AA that were high-bottom. More and more women were coming in. People were coming in at a younger age. They said, we need to change those stories in the back of the book. There's where the newcomer finds their identification. So they came out with the second edition, did the same thing in 1976, did the same thing with this recent edition of the fourth edition, but the recovery program itself has been left absolutely unchanged, period. I think that's one of the greatest miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. God, you know how we love to change things. And everybody that's ever read this book has rewritten it in their mind at least twice. But collectively, we've never found it necessary to change our recovery program. I wonder why. It works, doesn't it? Works just as good today as it did in 1939. Why? I think there's three reasons. Number one, alcoholics haven't changed. You know, they're still doing the same thing today they did in 1939. They get drunk. They get in car wrecks. They get in knife fights. They get in hospitals. They get in divorce courts. They get in penitentiaries and they get in the graveyards. They're still doing the same things today that they were doing back in 1939. The same fun things, they think. Alcoholics haven't changed a lick. Alcohol hasn't changed. Oh, they've changed the names of it, the colors of it, the containers of it, but alcohol itself remained exactly the same thing as it was in 1939. You know, they got stuff today I never even heard of. I heard them talking not long ago about peach fuzz. God, I don't have any idea what peach fuzz is, but if it's got alcohol in it, it'd make me just drunker than hell, just sure as anything. Human nature never changes. It's the same thing today that it was 2,000 or 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. And that's what this book really deals with. It deals with the alcoholic. It deals with alcohol. It deals with human nature. Collectively, we've never found it necessary to change it. I think that's a real miracle.
You know, as far as the table of contents is concerned, I think if we will get the picture of the table of contents, which Charlie went over a while ago, and realize that this book is laid out in a certain sequence to bring about certain ideas, that each page and each chapter is right where it belongs, this book becomes a very fascinating book. It opens up, because as I said, and most people read it haphazardly back and forth all over the place. I was in the printing business all my life. I owned a company that printed books like this. I've sat in on many, many meetings about how to lay out a book. I know these things. It never dawned on me that this book was laid out in that way. After all, a bunch of old drunks wrote it, so what would they know about a book? Come to find out, they had a lot of good information about how to lay out a book. They got that from some very learned men and women in the printing field about how to lay out a book. But this book becomes very, very fascinating. Again, it's like Charlie said, transfer information from the mind of one group of people to the reader of the book, increasing the knowledge of the reader of the book. And that's what we need, is the knowledge of, about alcoholism. I didn't know about alcoholism before I come to AA. Where would I have learned that? They didn't talk about these things in the bars I hung around in.
Didn't talk about it in the Zebra Lounge at all?
No, not in the Zebra Lounge or the Misty Dawn, for sure. So I was uninformed, and I needed to be informed about what my problem really is, and I didn't know. But this book tells me. It's a fascinating book once you understand how it's laid out. And then the book becomes open up our minds to the possibilities.
As I read it today, I love to think about the idea that the first 100 men and women are transferring information from their mind through the written word to my mind. Mm-hmm. And teaching me what they knew about how to recover from alcoholism. And that's all any textbook ever does. Certainly that's all this one does. Let's go to the foreword to the first edition for just a moment. Roman numeral 13.
13. And it says we. And that's the biggest word in Alcoholics Anonymous, we. We can do what I cannot do. In the foreword to the first edition, the word we is used 17 different times. The other forwards, we is not used as much. In the fourth edition, we is not used at all. Now, what kind of message that is, but in the beginning, it was a we program. We can do what I cannot do. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Two different things, important to know. Later on tonight, we're going to separate the body from the mind. We're going to talk about the body in great detail. Then we'll talk about the mind in great detail. talking about both of them. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You see words in here that are called italic. Charlie calls them squiggly writing. You might get confused a little bit if you it is italic. And when you see the words italic in this book, it's important to be read again. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Later on in our book, we're going to see words like specifically, exactly, with clear-cut directions. So this is a book that's going to tell us precisely, specifically, exactly, with clear-cut directions on how to recover. And if I want to recover the way the first 100 men and women recovered, guess what? I need to do precisely, specifically, exactly, follow the clear-cut directions, or I may not recover from alcoholism. For them, we hope the page will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experience will help everyone better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. Many people today don't realize that we're very sick people. Many people in the fellowship don't realize we're very sick people. Many people in the fellowship treat it as if it's a moral issue, even today. But it's an illness of the body and of the mind. Most illnesses that we know of today is either physical or it's a mental illness. The thing that's so baffling about this one is it's part physical and part mental. And we need to understand that, and which we're going to talk about a little bit more later on.
Two little ideas. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women. When I see that statement, I'm alerted to the fact that this is not a one-person, one-author book. You know, most books I read have been authored by one person. And if I see something in a book that's authored by one person, I don't agree with it. I usually say, well, who in the hell are they to think they're smarter than I am? And I just ignore it. But if I do that with the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not going to be arguing with one person. I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women. They told Bill in 1937, the first 40 said, Bill, we want you to write the book. They said, you know more about it than anybody else does. And you've been sober longer than anybody else. And at that time, just a little over 3 years. But they said, Bill, this is not to be your book. It's to be our book. And as you write those chapters, we want to see them. And we will add to, change around, delete from, whatever is necessary. When we're through with it, it'll be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all 40 of us. By the time the book was finished, that was 100 instead of 40. So I've got to remember today that if I'm going to argue with what's in the content of this book, then I'm not going to be arguing with one person. I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women. And I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women who have recovered from the same thing is killing me as a practicing alcoholic, a hopeless state of mind and body. And when I realize that, it makes it a little more difficult for me to argue with it. When I realize that I'm dealing here with 100 people who have recovered from the same thing as killing me, I think the other thing that is so important, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You know, it's kind of like making cake. Let's say we go to a potluck meeting in AA somewhere. Somebody's made a beautiful strawberry cake. That's my favorite cake. If you ever make me one, please make it strawberry. I love it.
Every once in a while, somebody brings him a strawberry cake and we get lucky.
Yeah. And I bite into that cake and it's just perfect. The texture's right. The moisture content's right. The taste is right. Everything is just right. And I say, who made this cake? Well, you being a good cook, you'd say, well, I made it. And I say, well, would you tell me how you did it? And you say, yeah, I'll be glad to. And you sit down and you write out for me a precise set of directions on how to make that cake. You tell me the ingredients to put in it, the quantity of the ingredients to put in it, the sequence in which to mix them together, the temperature at which to bake it, and how long to bake it. Now, if I take your directions in my kitchen and I follow them precisely as you've laid them out, Now, when that thing comes out of the oven and cools off and I bite into it, I think I could expect it to taste exactly like your cake tasted. But if I take your directions in my kitchen and my keen intellectual alcoholic mind begins to work, it may say, well, now I'm not sure about this 2 cups of sugar. It probably really ought to have 3. Or instead of 4 eggs, I think I ought to put 6 in it. Instead of baking at 375, it ought to be baked at 450. Instead of baking it for 18 minutes, I ought to bake it for 32. And when that thing comes out of the oven and cools off and I bite into it, sure, I'm going to be biting into a piece of cake. But I wonder how closely it would resemble your cake, which was my reason for making it in the first place. A precise, specific, clear-cut set of directions on how to recover from alcoholism. And if I don't want to recover as the first 100 did, and I follow those directions and I can expect to get what they caught, recovery. Which brings up the word recovery and recovered. We hear people fighting about this all over the country. Can you really recover from alcoholism? Well, by golly, I hope we can. If we can't, we're in a hell of a bad shape. I will never be cured of alcoholism. But I tell you what happened to me before I came to AA. I lived in a hopeless condition of body and mind. I could not drink without getting drunk. And I could not keep from drinking. And my life became an absolute living hell. I came to AA. I followed the program in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I still can't drink without getting drunk. But by golly, I don't have to drink. I've recovered from that hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism. I'll always be alcoholic, but I've recovered from alcoholism. And we're going to see the word recovered all the way through the book. Joe?
Now we're going to go to the doctor's opinion. Roman numeral page 23 in the third edition, and I believe it's 25 in the fourth edition. We'll try to keep up with those page numbers if we can. Doctor's opinion, very, very important. From it, we learn what our problem really is. See, I had no idea. It said that most people don't have any comprehension of our problem. I certainly didn't have any idea what my problem was. I come to AA my first time, and I stood in the back of the rooms, and I looked down at my feet, and I was ashamed of what I had become. Because I'd done everything that that anybody could do, and I was very ashamed of what I had become. And if you knew me like I knew me, you wouldn't like me either. I didn't like me. And I stood in the back of the rooms. Had no idea. I thought it was a moral issue. I thought that was my problem. 1975, we were in a hotel room way back, and Charlie and I and Joe and some other people were in my hotel room, and we were talking about the doctor. They were talking about the doctor's opinion. I was listening. And Charlie said, well, it's not a matter of morality. It's not a matter of sin. Not a matter of lack of willpower. And I said to myself, well, if it's not any of those things, what in the hell is it? What am I trying to recover from? You see, I need to know that. And we talked about the doctor's opinion. Now, what Charlie said earlier, the doctor, the big book had not been changed. Well, he made one little change. Big change in 1956 in the second printing of the book. They took the doctor's opinion off of page 1. In the first 16 printings of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the doctor's opinion was on page 1. They moved it into the Roman numeral sections. And you all know that we don't read Roman numeral sections, do we? Skip right over those babies. But the rest of this book, this whole book, is predicated on the understanding of the doctor's opinion. And if we don't understand the doctor's opinion, I don't know what we're doing in AA. You see? I've been at a number of meetings. I was in a meeting here a few months ago, and there was about 35 people in an hour meeting. And this one guy had been talking for 20 minutes. You know him. There was an old boy sitting next to me, old Dick, old timer in AA, and I kind of punched him. I said, Dick, what's he talking about? He said, I don't know. He never says. But he wasn't talking about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand it. But the doctor's opinion, very, very important. and need to know and understand that, because the rest of the book is going to tell us how to recover from that condition of body and mind that he talks about. That was Bill's first experience in recovery. He was in the hospital, I think, 3 different times. And each time, Dr. Silkworth explained to him what his opinion was at that time. And another little story years ago, about 8 or 10 years ago, I was talking at a place, you call it leading here, we would call it talking down there. And after the meeting, this fellow, an old timer, come up to me and said, "What were you reading?" And I said, "Well, I was reading a doctor's opinion." And he said, "Well, what book did you get it out of?" And I said, "Well, out of this big book." I had one of those softback versions of the big book that had just come out. He said, "Show that to me," and I did. And he left. The next day he walked up to me. Before he got to me, he started crying. I mean, real big tears. He said, "Joe, I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sober